Welcome to Prosecco and Prose, episode 26.
This week's Prosecco is Casa Sant Orsola.
This week's prose is The Four Winds by Kristen Hanna. Thank you for joining us for an episode of Prosecco and Prose. I'm Amy.
And I'm Wendy. We're a deep dive virtual book club.
That's kind of like a quiz-free lit class you never knew you needed.
So let's
pop a cork for this week's episode of Prosecco and Prose.
For those who are listening in the car, please don't drink and drive.
Save the bubbly for later.
Hopefully, there are no mistakes with the Prosecco opening today, Amy.
There'll be no explosions today, Miss Know-It-All Bossy Pants. I followed the directions.
That's good, because I'd hate for this time to have the cork pop and cause actual damage. You know I have no room in our little apartment to set up a recording studio if Josh kicks us out of here. Maybe the guest bathroom, though?
That's okay. Though the acoustics might be worth a try. Now, speaking of acoustics, guys, if I sound a little different today...
Like she has a dust bowl breathing voice.
Yes. I had a little procedure this weekend at the doctor. I'm A-okay, but I am kind of given the after effects of it, so...
A little raspiness.
It's okay, but I want to let our listeners know that I followed your sticky note rules you attached to the bottle today.
I just wanted to make sure you didn't miss it.
I'm going to go ahead and share your sticky note rules with our friends. Okay. Amy, exclamation mark, exclamation mark, exclamation mark.
I like exclamation marks. Usually I like to make a smiley, but you didn't.
They're angry.
Yeah, but normally I put a smiley, but I put three because I didn't want you to mess up.
Okay.
Continue.
Okay. Prosecco things to remember prior to recording, exclamation mark. Number one, only remove foil.
Do you like how I underlined only?
Yes, nothing else. Number two, do not was underlined.
And capitalized.
Loosen the cage prior to recording. Exclamation mark. And number three, again, do not, she double underlined that, loosen the cage. Mm-hmm. You know, the wiry thing wrapped around the cork.
I just wanted to make sure.
You didn't have to write that twice, though.
Clearly I did.
You know, I learned my lesson last episode.
Well.
Hopefully Josh doesn't listen and come in and inspect our ceiling.
Hopefully not. But sometimes, my friend, you need some gentle reminders. That's all I'm saying. Or not gentle.
This is true. And now I truly know what the cage is for.
You knew before. You just never tested the theory.
Well, now I know for sure, exclamation mark.
I think it's important we fully understand this Prosecco corking business. And now we do, right?
Right.
If you see a string, we know there isn't enough pressure to pop the cork.
Well, not without a corkscrew.
Right.
That would be our Frizzante Prosecco. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a step down from Spumante, which is what we're most familiar with. You know, our full Perlage stuff. After last episode's escapade, I had to do a little bit of bubble research.
Oh? So what new thing about Prosecco did you discover?
Well, do you know there is this Prosecco that is still, you know, S-T-I-L-L, still like flat?
I know what still means.
Well, but some of our listeners might not.
Oh, yeah, you're right. It is more European. But how is that even Prosecco? No bubbles? Wouldn't that just be white wine?
Well, that's what I thought. But it's very rare. Is only 5% of the Prosecco production. It's called, get this, Tranquillo or Calmo.
Oh, fitting.
And is the first variety to be bottled, as Frizzante and Spumante require a second fermentation. You know, for the bubbles.
Right, for the bubbles. That's interesting, though. And I mean, I like the bubbles. I wonder if it still qualifies because it's made with Glera grapes?
Yes, about it being made with the grapes. And I like the bubbles, too. So perusing the Google webs, I found this website that is the it's the regulatory body for Prosecco.
Mm.
It was pretty interesting.
That would be. And I guess I would be intrigued to try Tranquillo or Calmo.
Oh, me too. But we'll have to take a trip to try. The site says it's rarely exported outside of Italy.
Well, I guess we'll have to visit. Twist my arm.
In the name of research, of course.
Of course. Now, our Prosecco today, it's such a perfect match to our beautiful book cover, don't you think?
Oh, so perfecto.
Mm.
The colors, the simplicity of the book cover, and this Casa Sant Orsola label. You know, the grains of wheat on the side kind of look like bubbles.
They do. So this Prosecco is a DOC.
Basic level.
Yes, extra dry. 11% and part of this Eleonora collection, which I honestly couldn't find anything on, but thought it a bit of a connection to our character Elsinore.
Oh, didn't even think of that. So what was the rating on it?
Well, it gets a 3.8. So, you know, that's not bad.
Oh, not bad at all. Especially for less than $5 a bottle. I'd say it's a little on the cheap. I hope it's good. I might have a new budget brand in the future. Sorry, Asolo.
I know, right? I did see that the average cost is about $7, which, you know, it's still a great deal. Mm-hmm. All right, let me see the bottle really quick. Got to keep it chilled.
Yeah.
Warm Prosecco is not a good Prosecco. So our label notes say, this wine is fresh. Wow, it's written really, really tiny.
Do you need my readers?
Or a magnifying glass. Hold on.
Readers. I'm getting old, guys.
If I hold it far enough away, I can read it. Okay, I got it. This wine is fresh, fruity, and pleasantly sparkling, with flavors reminiscent of grape, apple, and white peach. Sorry, stumbling a little, guys. Ideal as an aperitif, it matches with all dishes.
Well, of course they would say that. It's like, so you'll drink more. But I kind of agree with them. I like Prosecco with most anything.
Same.
Gosh, I sound Dust Bowl, don't I?
You do. Here, you can have it back.
Goodness gracious.
No cage unwinding it. It is very pale yellow. It's almost clear in the bottle.
I noticed that the color is a very light yellow, too. All right, let's pop this bad boy and get her poured.
I'm ready.
Okay.
You can take the cage off now, Amy.
I am taking the cage off.
Okay, perfect.
Wow. Now I'm...
We won't have a nice pop like before, probably, but... Ooh.
Ooh.
That was poppy.
Okay, let me see your glass.
Okay. Ooh. It's foamy.
Well, the Prelati is moderate. Mm-hmm. A little foamy on the pour, but it settles down pretty quickly.
Yeah, it's actually very light bubbles in the glass. Okay. Ooh. Wow, this is interesting. That almost stung.
Interesting as in good or interesting as in bad?
Well, it smells a little skunky to me.
Skunky? Oh, great. Now we know why it was $5. Third time might not be a charm. Let me smell. Okay, for me, not getting skunk. It's more of an earthy or... maybe like a wildflower smell?
Yeah, okay. I'm getting some floral. It actually... Okay, so it kind of makes me think of a flower with thistles. I can picture them now. They used to be like in the ditches when we baled hay.
Interesting. Let's see how the taste matches up with the smell.
I'm hoping for no taste match with the smell I have.
Okay. I can taste citrus. Let me see. I can taste the green apple, but I gotta say, this one's a bit different. I mean, first sip, not overly fond of it, but I'm holding on to hope that it could change.
It's pretty fizzy in the mouth for me.
Yeah.
It feels citrusy, but it doesn't necessarily taste citrus, if that makes sense, like to me.
I can see that.
Okay, I'm getting grape with green apple.
Definitely can taste the green apple here.
Actually, it's like green grape with green apple. Like, it almost tastes green or something to me.
Green grape, huh? I mean, that's pretty specific. I'm pretty sure Glare grapes are green, Wendy. So that sort of seems like a given.
I suppose. But I'm thinking more of the green table grapes taste, smart aleck.
Oh, okay. I get you.
And I'm not initially opposed, like you seem to be. I can see your face. This isn't necessarily a favorite right now. But I'm curious to see how it goes.
Holding on to hope, like Elsa, our main character. Okay, so on to our author. Kristen Hanna is a former lawyer turned author and has written 24 novels. Her best-selling work is The Nightingale, which I have not had the chance to read yet. I see it all over Insta. I mean, it sounds really, really intriguing. I read that it's being made into a movie. Have you read it?
I haven't, but I'm intrigued as well, particularly because of the setting and the time period. We like that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But I'm also very interested in Homefront. Have you read that one?
No, I haven't.
Well, the synopsis made me think of Beyond the Point.
Oh, which was one of our favorite episodes we recorded last year.
Yes. So, same kind of thing. It's a female soldier who deploys, and the story shows the effects of war, you know, that it has on individuals, families, and marriages.
Oh, wow. We'll definitely add that to my TBR list.
Yeah, ours must be like a mountain by now, right?
Yeah, I've got books hidden all over the house.
We have to.
Anyway, now The Four Winds was published in 2021, and if you want to learn even more about Kristen Hanna, be sure to check out her webpage. It's real easy. It's kristenhanna.com. And Kristen with an I-N. You know, a lot of people think it's E-N, but I am an Amy Kristen. She's got fun facts on this website, book club discussion guides, and it has a fun list of all her favorites.
Right.
Like movies, books, places, drinks. Our old stomping grounds of Nashville even made the list. I'll put the link in our show notes.
Good food, interesting people. Mm. What's not to love? Music on the street? I'm going to have to check out her book list, even though I probably should finish what's on my current stack before adding.
I know, but there's always another great book out there.
There always is. Let's get to our characters.
There are quite a few in this novel, but we'll just briefly introduce the main ones here.
Okay.
Okay, so we have our protagonist, Elsinore, or Elsa Wilcott. She comes from a quite well-to-do family. Mm-hmm. Then we have Rafe Martinelli, Elsa's eventual husband and father of their children, daughter Loretta and son Anthony. We have Tony and Rose Martinelli, or Rafe's parents and farmers. And I think we should mention Jeb and Jean Dewey.
Oh, yeah.
The family Elsa befriends at the labor camp out in California. And then also Jack Valen, a head organizer for the labor unions for the migrant workers there in California. I think we'll leave it with those so it doesn't get too confusing during our discussion. There are other characters in there. But
loads of characters. Yeah. I agree. What was Rafe's name? Because he said you could call him Rafe. Do you remember? I can't even.
Raphael. Wasn't it Raphael, maybe? I'll have to look it up.
Raffaello?
Yeah.
It was something very
Italiano.
Yeah, very Italiano. Mm. Okay, so our story is told in four parts, and each part is noted by a year. So it starts, it has a prologue, which we'll get to later, and it's beautiful. But it starts in 1921 in the Texas Panhandle. Elsa is 25. Oh, ancient, right? Unmarried, considered unpretty, and at 6 feet tall, too tall for most men. She got very sick at 14 and left school, but dreams of going to college to be a writer. But her father, he put the kibosh on that.
Oh, he did.
Elsa sneaks out one night and meets Rafe Martinelli, whom she sleeps with. In the truck bed. Elsa's mother discovers she is pregnant, which shocks Elsa as she didn't think she would ever have a family and knows so little about these things. That scene was so ingrained in my mind. Yours too?
Yeah, yeah.
She's just like, what are you talking about? She confesses to being with Rafe, and her father takes her to the Martinelli farm and disowns her. Rafe, though engaged to another, marries Elsa, and the family, Tony and Rose, take her in. Elsa finds her place on the Martinelli farm and in their family, and baby Loretta is born.
Okay, so the next part of our novel, the next section, happens in 1934 in the Texas Panhandle. The community has fallen on hard times with the Great Depression. I mean, there were ongoing droughts, frequent dust storms. Rafe and Elsa have added to their family, a son, Anthony, nicknamed Aunt, A-N-T, who is now 7. Loretta, now 12, resents her mother.
Of course she does.
Always working. And, you know, she's never smiling. But, you know, Loretta has a close bond with her father, who drinks heavily to drown his miseries and dreams of going west for a better life. Now, Loretta also shares the dreams of her father, and she really wants to leave with him. So one night, Rafe shares his desire to go west with Elsa. Elsa hesitates. She's tells him Tony and Rose, you know, his parents will never leave the farm. And they don't have the money or even the shoes to walk that far. Rafe resigns, but in the morning, he's gone, only leaving a note. Loretta, the daughter, blames her mother for her father leaving. So the drought continues, animals die, more farmers are leaving, and a severe, like a week-long dust storm sends Aunt to the hospital, where the doctors tell Elsa that if she wants him to survive, they have got to leave Texas for clearer air.
Yep.
And I definitely know the feeling there.
Right.
The Martinellis packed up to leave, but just as Elsa is getting ready to depart, you know, Tony and Rose reveal that they're going to go ahead and stay back. They decide to take the government payment to seed grass on their farm to try and actually save it. Elsa reluctantly leaves with Loretta and Aunt.
Yeah, she wasn't excited to do that.
I wouldn't either. I mean, she found a family that loved her and she loved back.
So now it's 1935, California. Elsa, Loretta, and Aunt make their way to California, but not before nearly losing the truck in an overheating incident when crossing the desert. Seeing the lush green land and fields, they feel hopeful, but are quickly jolted into a harsh new reality when they are rejected and name-called in a shop when trying to secure a place to live. The family ends up in a shantytown, though Elsa promises it will be just for a night. Right? I mean, they're just...
One night.
Yeah, one night. Their new neighbors, Jeb and Jean, encourage Elsa to sign up at the relief office. They have been living in the camp for 9 months.
Wow.
Do you remember how she felt like just learning that? Yeah. But she resists signing up at the relief office. Her family doesn't need a handout. But after a 10-hour day of work and Elsa only makes 40 cents, she signs up and learns it will be a year before they can receive any assistance.
Wow.
She enrolls the children in school, where they are teased and bullied, name-called, while she looks for work, often unsuccessfully, during the day. She finally gets work picking cotton, which just sounds like a horrible thing to have to do, right?
Bloody fingers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Loretta joins her once school is out. But even with both of them working, Elsa realizes they will not have enough to get them through the winter, let alone leave the shantytown. And she starts going to the food line for help.
So depressing.
Yeah.
So the next section of the book, guys, takes place in 1936 in California. Elsa's friend Jean goes into labor. She had been pregnant. And then when the hospital turns her away because they don't help migrant workers, the baby is eventually delivered stillborn.
So sad.
Loretta, frustrated and angry at how they live, how they, you know, the migrants are treated, runs away and is picked up by Jack, the union leader or the union organizer we learn about. Sneaking into the meeting he stops at, Loretta wants to join the cause and shares this when she returns home to her mother. Elsa just doesn't want the trouble and tells Loretta not to get involved, as a, you know, any good parent would, right?
She just wants to keep her head down and save money and work. Yep.
After days of rain, a flash flood wipes out this migrant camp and all of the Martinellis' belongings, to include the remaining money they have, is gone.
It was like a punch in the gut.
Right. But thankfully, the truck starts up and then they head into town where Jack, you know, he finds them a place for the night and then finds them, a more
stable
place on Wilty Farms. But not before he encourages Elsa to join the fight for workers' rights. While they have a roof, you know, they have a real floor, they have beds, food, they have electricity and steady work, Elsa soon realizes that this Wilty Farms is a setup to keep workers indebted to them.
Mm-hmm.
Their wages begin to decrease, and Elsa realizes if she wants to change her situation, she needs to definitely take up the fight. But using her voice is going to be dangerous, and she is shot. And where I'm going to leave with this is she asks Jack to take Loretta and Aunt back to Texas.
So then we have the epilogue.
Right.
1940. So, and we're back in Texas. Loretta, 18, and Aunt are living with their grandparents, Tony and Rosa, on the farm where things are growing and beginning to thrive again. Loretta is about to return to California as the first Martinelli to go to college. Remember, that was going to be Rafe.
Right.
This book, I mean... Yeah, it just hit me in such a way that I actually wasn't even able to pick up another book for a couple of weeks, like just to process it.
I know. I mean, I actually went through half a box of Kleenex while reading it. It was just so, so good. And it's
so
a
good.
Really emotional read.
Yeah, be prepared.
You actually finished this one before I did, which hasn't happened since...
way back in season one.
Right.
When life gives you Lululemons. And really, that's only because I had actually read that one a while ago, and I suggested it to you. Like, I'd already read it.
I like to stay ahead of our local speed reader here. But, you know, that was such a fun book, Lululemons.
It was. That was a fun episode.
Fun episode to discuss, yeah.
Little brandy slush has got a little bit too much, but...
Right. But back to the Four Winds.
Four Winds.
No tangents.
Yes.
This was actually a listener's request, wasn't it?
It was. And I have to say, this was a very good one. And in that note, heads up, friends, we're thinking of theming our next season around love. So if any of you have some recommendations for that, we'd love to hear them. You can DM us. You can send us a message.
When you rate and review us, go ahead and just slide that
slide
in.
Slide that right in there.
I just love listener recs. Don't forget about sharing your favorite short stories, too. You know,
that's right.
We never get short story requests, just novels.
I know.
But thinking about it, The Four Winds shares the theme of love, too.
It really does. I get, yeah.
We can talk about it again.
We could talk about, I mean, I could talk about this book for a while.
Right.
And I think we'll get some of that here. You know, it's just, we're just going to look at it with our power angle.
I think so. But before we do, I think we need to also mention that this book fell into one of our combined favorite genres.
Oh, it did. Historical fiction.
Yes, historical fiction. As Bedford so says, he's so smart.
He's very smart.
That historical fiction is a novel that makes use of historical events.
Like the Great Depression, the Dust Bowl, the migration of people suffering from those events to California.
Exactly. But it could also be historical figures. Mm-hmm. Sir Walter Scott, a Scottish poet and novelist, is often credited with inaugurating the historical novel in England. And all but one of his 27 novels have historical settings.
He liked his history.
It surely seems he did. Now, another significant influence on the historical novel is something I think, if I remember right, you studied a bit of while you were getting your master's degree. Didn't you study Gothic literature?
Yes, I did. And I loved it. And I can see that. We've got Destructive Love, Rafe and Elsa, Elsa and Lareda.
Oh, right.
Maybe even Lareda and Rafe, you think?
Maybe.
Gloomy, bleak landscapes.
Right, definitely.
The constant dust and the death of both crops and animals. I think they'll speak to Gothic elements.
I know love isn't our theme this season, and I'm stretching here, but it also seemed to be a bit of a historical romance.
I'm not sure Rafe and Elsa were a great romance. I mean, more the Gothic destructive love kind, maybe.
Not them, silly. I'm talking about Jack and Elsa.
Ah, okay. But not a lot of romance in the book.
No, I agree, but there is a bit, and that's all I'm going to say. I was rooting for them all the way to the end.
True. There is a bit. And in that thought, we felt our power in this novel was in love and family.
Love and family were so intertwined. Because for me, I kept thinking back to Elsa, you know, when she was a young girl. She didn't have the love of her family, and she so craved it. I was just so sad for her.
Oh, same. I mean, by withholding their love, her family disempowered Elsa. And she really felt this sense of abandonment from them. And that was before they literally abandoned her.
Oh, I know. Now, Elsa did have one familial loving relationship that we learned about in the story. Remember her grandfather?
I do. He and Elsa, they had a pretty special bond. They both shared a love of reading, and he would often take her side in family disagreements.
Well, when he passed, she was alone. She felt alone. Really an outsider in her own family. She even thinks that it seems like her family always wants her to be ill, sick.
Well, constantly reminding her that her body is weak and not exactly pleasing to the eye and that she's too tall, too old. Those are all just ways for her family to wield their power over her.
Oh, I completely agree. It was just really upsetting.
Mm-hmm.
I think this was why she enjoyed reading so much. I mean, she turned to books because she could find love in the pages and dream about it for herself. I mean, it gave her something to hope for, in a sense. Reading was a powerful escape for her, wouldn't you say?
True. But I think it could also be seen as a weakness.
Really? How so?
Well, the love she was reading about gave her an unrealistic expectation about what love was, even what sex was. Remember the saucy memoirs of a woman of pleasure?
Oh, how could I not? This was her most treasured novel.
Most treasured.
I have to think her parents either A, didn't know she had it, or B, knew she had it, but had no idea what it was about.
I'm going with A. We know Elsa can be a little sneaky.
She had to be. they would have locked her in a room forever with a chastity belt. And not to mention, I swear they were borderline Munchausen syndrome by proxy. Think?
Yeah. I mean, they did act like she was still sick or about to be sick or just recovering from being sick. But that book, the memoirs book, it was quite scandalous. I know we talked about this a little bit. I mean, it was written in 1749 and the pictures I found online, whew, let me tell you.
After I got all your texts initially when you had looked this book up, you know I had to do my own research.
Of course.
So I went one step ahead of you and I downloaded the audio version.
Of course you did.
Oh my God. How can I say this? I started listening to it on the plane and it was like, hashtag, my loins were burning. But did you know that the author, John Cleland, wrote this book while he was in debtor's prison?
I didn't know that.
I mean, he had nothing else to do.
Well, yeah. He definitely was frustrated.
Yeah, he was. I mean, it was considered the first English prose pornography book.
Mm-hmm.
I'll put a link to it in the show notes, as I know a few of our listeners who will listen or want to look.
Of course you will link it. Maybe not the picture book.
Oh, no, it's happening. But a tantalizing, scandalous read aside, I think this small detail, you know, gave us just real insight into our dirty little porno princess Elsa.
Seriously?
Just kidding.
Okay. I wouldn't go that far, but that's funny.
I mean, this is such a serious book. I had to bring some humor into it.
Of course you did, of course. And it was pretty serious. So no one in her family was talking to her. You know, except about whether she was sick, about to be sick, ugly, old, or too tall. I think I've mentioned this.
You've beat a dead horse, yeah.
But I mean...
But it was true.
Right, that's all they were doing. So naturally curious, she sought out answers on her own.
Unfortunately, this particular book only provided a fantasy. A fantasy she kept waiting to have happen to her.
Which was not what happened with Rafe.
No. And that's another example of Elsa losing the power of love.
You are so right. And you've got me thinking back to their conversation the first time they were together. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Rafe asks if he can love her. And what does she want more than anything?
Like in the back of the truck? She wants love.
Right.
She wants love. I think she thought she knew what that meant, you know, from her book, but I'm not sure she really did.
I'm not sure either. I don't think the book, yeah. And I'm pretty sure it did not live up to what she read in her treasured memoirs book.
I would definitely say not.
Yeah, definitely not.
But her dalliance with Rafe did lead her to a family that, you know, just truly loved and accepted her.
Right.
A family that did empower her, right?
Yes, the Martinellis. But they were resistant at first. I mean, Rafe was engaged to someone else.
He was. But to give Rose, you know, his mom, the benefit of the doubt, I don't know how quickly I would have warmed up to a random girl my son, you know, got pregnant out of wedlock.
Right.
I'd need some time to accept the situation.
Fair point, and one I cannot relate to. But Rose did warm up. I mean, she really became the mother Elsa, you know, never had.
The Martinellis actually became the family Elsa never had.
Yeah.
And that power of family and the power of love that came with it gave Elsa strength when Rafe rejected her. She also felt that powerful strength when her parents rejected her. Remember when she brought Loretta to meet them after being estranged?
Right. And they just commented on
her
color.
And, you know, even when her own daughter, Loretta, rejected her.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Aunt went to the hospital. And then finally when she ended up having to go west. I mean, she was such a strong woman.
She was. And, you know, that love also and that family, it continued to strengthen and give her the power and will to survive while out west, even while they were separated. The grueling work days, seeing her own children suffer and have to work, giving part of her money and supplies to Jeb and Jean.
Oh, right.
Picking up again when the flood washed everything away.
Ugh.
I mean, honestly, I don't know how she did it. I'm not sure I could have even left in the first place.
But that's really the point, Wendy. You know, the power of her love for her family couldn't let her stay. She had to go in order to save Aunt.
True.
And the Martinellis also proved the power of their love and family by giving, you know, everything they had to help Elsa and the kids go west. I'm sure a part of them believed, you know, that they'd never see them again.
Again, true.
But they were all able to do what they had to do. Elsa to leave, and Tony and Rose to help them go because they had family and they had love. They had the power that gave them the strength to make those hard decisions.
And, you know, it's really such a contrast to when Elsa was left by her parents. She was abandoned.
Right.
And here she is leaving her family. But it's that's not abandonment at all.
No, it's really not. I mean, she always has a home there. Not just a house, but a home, which is what the love of family makes it. Mm-hmm. Then out west, she found a family in the form of Jeb and Jean.
Right. But, I mean, I don't think she wanted to form any kind of bond with them. I mean, at least initially.
Well, I agree. But she soon realized the migrant workers needed each other just to survive. Mm-hmm. It kind of reminds me of our lives, you know, moving all the time with the military. We find our Jebs, we find our Jeans, mm-hmm. Those that help, you know, to make our house a home.
We do. We always do.
Right.
So the power of family and love not only helped Elsa survive, but it also helped Tony and Rosa and Loretta and Aunt.
Right.
You know, I kind of feel like we've swapped places here. You're all into themes, and I gotta tell you, I can hardly wait to get to symbols.
Is that your polite way of saying it's time to move on?
It's just a hint that I'm excited to talk about the symbols we found.
Oh, I am too, because we found some really good ones.
They were. So let's start with our penny, the wheat penny.
Oh, so much in that little copper coin.
Loaded.
I want to read the first part of the prologue because it really sets up our story and, you know, it lets the reader know how important the penny is.
Okay.
Hope is a coin I carry, an American penny given to me by a man I came to love. There were times in my journey when it felt as if that penny and the hope it represented were the only things that kept me going. Come to think of it, part of that was also in the last passage in the epilogue. But I think the line was changed, given to me by a woman I will always love.
Oh, yeah, because it's Loretta in that.
Right.
Yeah.
Love when quotes or passages act as bookends to a story.
I do, too. And that was, I mean, it was such a great beginning, and I agree, a great ending to our story. Now, Tony had found the penny outside of Rosa's parents' home on the day they were set to leave for America, which is just, like, so fitting.
Oh, it was.
Because a penny is a symbol of new beginnings.
So Tony and Rose also passed that penny along to Elsa when she set off for California. So I think that was a third time that that passage was in there. I think that was in there three times.
Yeah.
I'll have to go back and look.
Right. But then Elsa passes it along to Loretta.
Right, at the end of the story.
Mm-hmm. So now, a wheat penny was one of the longest-running coins in U.S. history, from 1909 to 1958, and it replaced the Indian head penny. So the stalks of wheat, and, you know, they described the coin with the stalks of wheat on it, mm-hmm. it symbolized the nation's prosperity.
And Rose said the wheat revealed their destiny, which they came to grow on their farm. It was their prosperity in America.
This penny just had so much meaning. The copper symbolizes bright ideas, fresh perspectives, and an incorporating of new thoughts with the old. By combining old with new, one finds their lives expanded and new directions on their path.
That makes me think of the winemaking that Tony did.
Ooh.
You know, telling Elsa the grapes were cuttings he brought from Sicily, you know, and that his wine reminded him of his father, binding them together. I mean, again, the power of family.
I mean, it's all through, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the wheat on the penny symbolizes the nation's prosperity, right?
Mm-hmm.
As we mentioned. But wheat also symbolizes fertility of the earth, rebirth, and abundance.
Well, for many years, that's what happened for the Martinellis on the farm, you know, planting the wheat. Mm-hmm. They had all they needed.
Especially, you know, the food to survive, which wheat is often synonymous with.
Loaded little wheat penny.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's talk about the aster flower, the one Elsa spared precious water to keep alive just outside the kitchen window.
And at the end, remember that? The asters grew along the fence of the family cemetery.
Oh, right, they did.
Now you're a resident horticulturist. What's an aster?
Well, I wouldn't go that far as a horticulturist, but
I
do know a little bit about plants. I like to study them. But an aster is a star-shaped flower. It's, you know, it's in the daisy family.
Oh, okay.
They are multiple colors. They can be pink, purple, red, orange, or white, which white was the color of Elsa's, you know, her calico aster. Mm-hmm. It was white with a pink center. And white, you know, as we know, symbolizes purity and innocence.
Mm. Well, you know I like my Greek mythology, right?
Oh, right.
And I read that the aster was, this is not horticulture stuff, okay?
Okay.
I read that the Astra was created by the tears of the Greek goddess Astraea.
Wow.
She was so upset by the lack of stars in the dark sky that she began to cry. As her tears fell to the ground, they turned into star-shaped aster flowers, and the flower was named after her. Aster, meaning star.
Always love your Greek spin on things, Wendy.
Thanks. Not exactly scientific, but...
But I think you'll find this interesting, too. We obviously did different research.
Yes.
Well, I never go to the Greek stuff. That's just not in my wheelhouse. But did you know that asters are drought resistant?
Oh, I mean, it makes sense.
They would have been really good Dust Bowl flowers to have.
Yeah.
I mean, Hannah really did her homework.
Oh, she did.
In writing this book. Now, the last thing I found about asters is that they represent love, wisdom, and faith. This is so fitting in the context of the story, as we saw love, we saw wisdom, and faith throughout the novel.
Well, Elsa was certainly putting her faith in that little plant.
She was.
She needed something to motivate her forward during those very, very challenging times.
She did. But both the penny and the aster come back to hope.
Oh?
Well, I found a little poetry when I was doing some research. I did. One of my little rabbit holes. I found a poem by Robert Frost. Mm. Love him.
Yes.
And it's called A Late Walk.
Okay,
it's just four little lines. I'll read it. I end not far from my going forth by picking the faded blue of the last remaining aster flower to carry again to you.
Mm.
You know, in this poem, the flower, to me at least, is a symbol of hope.
Ah.
The hope, you know, of like the narrator or the speaker of the poem returning to someone. And Elsa, in our story, holds on to this hope of the farm returning to its prosperity.
And I think you could even say hope for her and Loretta to have a better relationship.
Well, that's the thing about Elsa. I think she's full of hope. She may be pragmatic, but she's still really hopeful.
She kind of has to be. I mean, for everyone. But it wasn't easy. What a character, our Elsa.
She was incredible.
Mm-hmm.
She was one of those larger-than-life characters for me. I mean, one of my all-time favorites.
Mine too, really. But before we wrap up this title,
Four Winds,
right? I just kept coming back to it, trying to think of how Hannah came up with it.
Did you puzzle it out finally?
Well, I have my thoughts.
Okay.
And they could be out in left field, but the Four Winds in a biblical sense is a symbolic reference to storm winds coming from all directions and converging as a massive storm.
Interesting. You know, you just made me think of that saying, scattered to the four winds.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I think that means that things are kind of far and they're wide in all different directions.
I mean, but that fits as well. I mean, think about it. Think of how the families were scattered during this time because of all the storm winds.
I'd say it's a pretty perfect title.
I love it. And you know, speaking to those storm winds, the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl, which our story is so beautifully wound around, I loved how on her website, Hannah included a suggested reading list, because we always need more things to read, right? For more information about the Dust Bowl years and the migrant experience in California. I'm so fascinated by that time in our country. It made me want to go back and reread Steinbeck.
History is just so fascinating.
So,
you know, I'm very interested in Sonora Babb's novel, Whose Names Are Unknown, which was also mentioned in Kristen Hannah's acknowledgments.
Mm-hmm.
I guess you and I will never, ever run out of things to read.
That makes me very happy, I have to say. Any other thoughts on this incredible read?
I just want all of our listeners, if they haven't had a chance to read it yet, to go ahead and pick up a copy of this book.
Yes.
You will not be disappointed.
No.
It's really that good. I'll read it again in the future.
It's incredible. But what about the Prosecco? Final thoughts? Pairings? I mean, it doesn't look like it'll be replacing a solo from the looks of your glass.
No, I'll be sticking with my solo. You know, it just didn't really work for me.
Mm.
This is the first Prosecco that I can honestly, truly say I don't like, not even a little bit. I mean, it's bitter. It's kind of unpalatable. It's just sad. Although it's kind of a perfect pairing for a Dust Bowl story, right? I mean, I think I'll pair it with some OJ and maybe mimosa it out if I, you know, can't get the rest down the hatch. Maybe I'll toss it and just save the calories.
That could be good.
Ugh.
You know, the mimosa.
So what are your thoughts, Princess? I didn't see you exactly throwing it back or asking for seconds like you normally do.
Well, it's a bit plain to me.
Understatement.
And I get your bitter. Like I mentioned earlier, it kind of tastes like this thorny flowering weed I used to pull on the farm. But there is just a taste of honey on the finish. It's very, very subtle.
Any pairing thoughts?
Maybe a sharp cheese like a pecorino or a sharp cheddar. Like a strong, hard cheese, I think.
Yeah, it's a bit plain. Maybe it's just me because of my procedure this weekend, but I'm going to give it my lowest rating that I have yet. I'm going to give it a 3.1, and that's generous. This is just not my cup of tea.
That's generous. I actually thought you would have done a 2-something, honestly, the way you describe it. I'm going to go with a 3.3.
You liked it better than me then.
Just a bit. I think maybe it's the finish. Maybe we can make some fun drink from the rest.
Like I said, we can. Maybe try a mimosa.
You try that. I'm looking for something less breakfasty after lunch.
Then I guess I won't be inviting you to my afternoon Bellini bar party?
Well, I can drink Bellinis after lunch. I'm just not interested in OJ after lunch. In anything.
Well, la-ti-da.
Okay.
I'll leave out the OJ for you, Miss Pris, and the rest of you can join us in 2 weeks when we discuss Karen Russell's short story, Haunting Olivia, and pair it with, fingers crossed on this one, Luna de Oro.
Fingers crossed.
Cheers. Thanks again for joining us for an episode of Prosecco in Prose. To view the complete show notes for today's episode, visit www.proseccoinprose.com and follow the link to Buzzsprout.
Please follow or subscribe.
It's free wherever you listen, and you'll be the first to know when new episodes drop.
You can even show your support by rating and leaving us a review,
which helps other lit lovers discover our show.
Feel free to connect with us on our website or any of our social media.
Or you can find us on Clubhouse.
I'm Wendy.
And I'm Amy, signing off as our bottle of bubbly is now empty.
See you for the next episode, and in the meantime,
pop a cork and read.